And we are ready to start a new book, the book of Numbers. So yet, I don't know, it seems like we were in Leviticus a long time. I don't know that we were for actual class days, but... And actually, I like the book of Numbers, maybe because it's largely history and I'm a historian. And it's also about getting organized, and I like getting organized. So let's start off with the five W's. I was also thinking, I love teaching in the morning. I think one of these days when I'm old and full of days and I get to decide the schedule, I'll schedule myself all morning classes and make the new guys have the afternoon. So, numbers. Let's talk about the five W's. First one's pretty easy. It's widely accepted that Moses, like, was the author of Numbers, as with all of the Pentateuch. It's possible, as with Genesis, that some parts of Numbers consists of documents that could have even been composed by other people. In particular, I'm thinking of the census, the censuses, the two censuses, you know, those two counts. You know, and the listing, you know, some inventory type things. But for the most part, it's the work of Moses, perhaps all of that. It is worth you being aware, though, that modern Bible critics who think the Bible is not the inspired word of God and such will claim that four or five different authors wrote this account over the course of several centuries, and that it finally became complete during the time of Ezra the scribe. I don't think that's true. And I think Moses wrote it. I think it is likely, because we tend to believe that Ezra finished the compilation of the Old Testament, meaning gathering them together or canonizing the books. There is some indication that he might have done some minor editing, particularly places where in the Pentateuch you might see a modern name, like of a town. You'll see like Luz, which is now known as Bethel, or something like that. And it's thought that perhaps Ezra inserted those things to help what were then modern readers. Hard to think that, you know, around 300 BC, those were modern readers, but might have had some of that. Another thing we should mention within the book of Numbers, you might even want to glance over to chapter 12. Some people question whether or not Moses could be the author when he writes something as bold as what it says in Numbers 12 and verse 3. Somebody's there. What does it tell us? What does it say about Moses? David, are you there? Yeah. I see a lot of people turning.
You want me to read?
Sure, go ahead. It's pretty brief.
Now the man Moses was very humble, more than all men who were on the face of the earth.
Well, Moses was the most humble man on the face of the earth. Except how humble is it to write that about yourself? That leads some people to say, surely Moses wouldn't have written that about himself. Maybe somebody else is. To me, that's kind of weak when we have all this other evidence. Especially, who do we think or who do we give credit for really being the author of this? You know, say that again? Okay, God. If God inspired Moses and the other writers, he could have inspired Moses and perhaps even directly told him, I want you to write this. And Moses could be saying, God, really? I got to write this about myself? Yes. So if we believe it was inspired by God, which I do, you know, it's not such a stretch that God would have Moses write something pretty complimentary. Especially, I'll be with you a second, when we think that Moses in his writing also is fairly open about acknowledging his faults and his mistakes. So Moses doesn't whitewash either. Yeah, David?
I was just going to ask if we would also consider maybe Ezra inserting this, or would we not?
We could consider it, yeah. Or, well, that would be the best case if it was inserted by someone other than Moses. But it seems organic to the story right there. That's why I haven't seen many suggestions of that, or I think that's why. Yes, Charlie.
A later copier was inspired by the Holy Spirit. Could have wrote that.
Yeah,
that in there.
I'd say there's room for a possibility. As long as we acknowledge it would have been inspired by the Holy Spirit, meaning God leading it to happen. So, and that's the long way around saying I still think this is part of Moses' work. Which helps us to answer then the question of when was it written? Okay, considering what it describes and where it ends, it pretty much had to be written during Israel's 40 years of wandering. You know, wandering in the wilderness. The account begins, as we'll mention when we get into chapter and verse, 1 year and 1 month after the Exodus from Egypt. So that's where it picks up. It's a year and a month later from when they left Egypt. We've seen already from the latter part of Exodus and all of Leviticus that they've been busy with a lot of stuff. So, you know, what we covered, you know, recently only covered a year or so. Yeah, Julie?
Did you say 1 year and 1 month?
1 year and 1 month. As you see, remember, they went out. The Exodus was the 14th day of, well, actually, technically, the 15th day of the first month. That's when they went out because they had to stay in their homes the 14th, at least the overnight. Here in verse 1, it says, the first day of the second month of the second year. So, okay, now we're into the second month. You could say a year and half a month might be more correct, but we're not splitting hairs, we're splitting months. Yes, sure, sure.
It was 1 year and 1 month after they entered.
After they left Egypt. Yeah, so they left Egypt. Remember, they had to journey to get to Mount Sinai. They camped around there. God came and spoke to them. Moses goes up, they build a golden calf, Moses comes down and destroys it, he goes up again, he comes back, they build the tabernacle, and we're going to pick up here. At the end of Leviticus, we had, okay, the tabernacle is built, it's erected, the Shekinah glory comes in, God sends fire from heaven. Sounds a lot like what happened when Solomon dedicated the temple that Dr. Erweiler was going over with you, because it was very much the same. And we're going to pick up the story pretty much from there. Well, I'm giving the when, since we know where it fits in the story flow, it's worth reminding you that there are two generally accepted views of when the Exodus happened, which was a year and a month before. Some say around 1200 BC, others say around 1400 BC. And I've discussed this before, there's that two ways of looking at it and analyzing the documentation and saying, okay, were they in Egypt for about 200 years? Were they in Egypt for about 400 years? And I'm saying about, but I think God had a specific number and was very precise in how he did it. And to be honest, as I've looked at it, sometimes I've leaned more towards one interpretation and sometimes I find myself leaning towards the other. And in the long run, I say, well, it doesn't matter whether I know. It matters that it happened on God's schedule. That's the most important thing. Another thing I'll add before we leave when is we're not certain. Moses might have written this as they went because it's covering nearly 39 years of history. So he might have jotted some down now and then as they're wandering around in the wilderness. They're here all over, who knows, some maybe in the Sinai Peninsula, some in the Arabian Peninsula. Or it's possible as they finally get to where they're going, they come across the Jordan River from near Jericho, where they're going to cross over, right where you picked up with Joshua at the start of the school year. Some people would say maybe Moses wrote it all down at the end of all the wandering and picked up with writing what's now Deuteronomy. Does it matter? Not really. Matter of fact, I could see easily being a combination of both. Maybe Moses is writing things down, and when he's near the end of his life, maybe with God's guidance, there's this move to get all these different things he's been keeping track of and compile it into the book of Numbers as we know it. So that's the general when. He could not have written it after they entered the promised land. Am I right? For a pretty simple reason. Yeah, he's dead, so he's got to write it before he dies. He couldn't have written it before they start, you know, their trek away from Mount Sinai because it hadn't happened yet. So we've got a window of time. All these are pretty basic, but since we're covering the five W's, we might as well, you know, be clear about it. More open to question is why. Okay, and I don't think it's that difficult. The book of Numbers basically records Israel's wandering and the trials that Israel goes through in the time between leaving Egypt and before entering the promised land. That's why I say it's largely a history. It is often called a book of testing, partly because it covers about 40 years of Israel being tested, going through trials, you could say. That, combined with some other things in the Bible, have led some people to decide that 40 is officially the number of testing or the number of trial. I'm not much into numerology, but we can see the number 40 associated with some things like that. Why would we say 40 in this case? I think, or did I just say it? Okay, 40 years in the wilderness. What are some other 40 unit periods that we would think of? Can you say that? Okay, 40 days of fasting by who? Is that what you were going to say, Julie? Okay, who fasted 40 days? Okay, Moses did twice. Jesus Christ, is that what you're going to say, Andrew? And Elijah, yeah, those are all correct. So, yeah, Moses fasts 40 days while he's on Mount Sinai, two different times. Elijah fasts for 40 days traveling to Mount Sinai. Christ fasts for 40 days preparing to be tested by Satan. One more if you're keeping a list. I had this on optional things I wasn't necessarily going to cover, but since we're moving at such a rapid pace, we'll mention this when we get to the book of Jonah. This is a little different, but the one bit of prophecy in the book of Jonah is when he comes into Nineveh and he says, and yet 40 days and this city will be overthrown. That would be quite a trial. Someone walks into Milford and says, in 40 days, Milford's going to be destroyed. I might take stock of who I am and where I'm. Actually, I wouldn't. I'd say, I'm just staying home on the 40th day since I live in Amelia. But, you know, you could say that was a test, and the people of Nineveh passed that test. Okay, so Numbers, Book of Testings, it's also been called a book of faith. Actually, sadly, though, showing where Israel lacked faith. But we could say as an example to us, Christians should not lack faith. We should learn from their example. The Apostle Paul mentioned these things were written down as an example to us. So we should look at what they did and say, hey, we got to do different. And we can do differently for one very important, very powerful reason. We have something they didn't. Okay, the Holy Spirit. They had God right there with them, but we have God dwelling in us. And that makes a difference. Okay, I was looking for something. Maybe I've got it under the what. So, what? I've pretty much addressed this. Numbers is largely a historical account, mostly showing rebellion and punishment. And actually, there's three chapters that are all even-numbered chapters that show different rebellions. And they're not all the same, but I can mention it here. We already turned to Numbers 12. First, we have Aaron and Miriam sort of rebel slightly against Moses' leadership. Then, we skip ahead two chapters to chapter 14, we'll see the whole nation rebels at the idea of going into the Promised Land. Why? They're like giants. They've got fortified cities tall. We can never overcome them. Yeah. Then in chapter 16, we have what's called Korah's rebellion. A tribe and a part of the Levitical tribe decide Moses and Aaron are taking too much upon themselves. We're all holy people. And we'll see. God responds and shows who he wants to be in charge. There are some other things besides just history. For one thing, I mentioned two different censuses. I have that. Okay, who's a... I'll bet Jan would know. What? How do you say the plural of census? Sensi? Is it a Latin word? Sensi, that sounds too much like sensei, doesn't it? Yes, sensei. Okay, Kayla's got it. Censuses. Okay, so even though that sounds like I'm stuttering, that's the way to say it. Okay, the first one appears in chapter 1, so we'll be looking at it soon, about 13 months after leaving Egypt. A second census is recorded in chapter 26, so it's only 25 chapters later, but it's about 39 years later in history, recording an entirely new generation. What we'll see, and I actually will have a handout for you, so when we go through this, don't bother writing down all the numbers. I don't know why you would. They're written down in your Bible. It's nice to have them in a little table form to compare. But an entire generation later, the numbers in the census are very similar, at least the total number, showing God's great power. He leads a bunch of people in an absolute wilderness, and they survive, and they don't lose numbers. They actually lose a small number, but there's some significance in that. Because the reason they're wandering 40 years is because they didn't trust God to bring them into the Promised Land and conquer their enemy. We can never do it. They're going to destroy us and our children. So God says, okay, I'll do it with the children. 40 years later, when the first generation said, we can't do it, God says, okay, the next generation does do it. And you've gone through that in the book of Joshua. And they do it with fewer numbers. Not significantly fewer. My point going in was that it's nearly the same. But with fewer fighting men, they do what they're basically the previous generation feared and said they could not do. Because they were trusting their eyes and trusting a bad report, the next generation apparently had more trust in God. And there's a lesson for us that almost goes without saying, but guys, great subject of messages that you'll be given to congregations in the future. How we don't trust just our eyes and don't let our fears dominate us, but we trust what God can do. Might as well mention the title Numbers. That comes from the Latin numeri, N-U-M-E-R-I, which I think roughly means numbers. That was translated from the Greek arithmoi, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, A-R-I-T-H-O-M-O-I, the word from which we get arithmetic. Okay, and makes sense, there's a whole lot of numbers in here, but that's not what the Hebrews called it. If you're open to the start of Numbers, you see, now the Lord spoke to Moses. The original name was Vaidabar, V-A-I-D-A-B-B-E-R, which roughly means, and he spoke. So in the Pentateuch, the Hebrews like to just call the name of the book the first thing written in it. That was the official name, Vaidabar, and he spoke. But it became commonly known by a different name, V-A-I-D-A-B-B-E-R. I'm spelling it because if I write it on the board, I figure that'll be less effective. Although maybe I'll write this one, because it commonly became known as the next phrase, in the wilderness. So rather than calling it and he spoke, it became more commonly known in the wilderness, which is Bamidbar. That sounds like a candy bar, Bamidbar. I'll have a Bamidbar and a hot chocolate to go. Which means in the wilderness. So again, the Hebrews, they tended to call it by its first words. I like numbers. Actually, I mean, I like the name numbers. I'm not that fond of numbers themselves. I'm more of a word type guy. But we have lots of numbers in here, which is where we're going to go very quickly. That, for me, that concludes the five W's, unless I raise some W's among you. Yes? In the wilderness. I'm not sure how exact a translation it is. I don't know. Dr. Britt is good at... Okay, that's... And I didn't know if it was more of a general translation. Emily?
For Genesis, Exodus, and Leviticus, did they refer to them as that then, or did they refer to them as the beginning? I mean, what did they have, I guess?
Yeah, I think, actually, when we started the class, I gave them to you. So you might have them in your notes. But yeah, for each of them... The Hebrew name would be something from the first, like the name for Genesis meant in the beginning, which is what the name the word Genesis means. Exodus, trying to remember what the Hebrew name was. Oh, the names, yeah. The Hebrew name, they called it the word for names. And Leviticus. Probably because you thought this is a bunch of goofy Hebrew words. What do I need? And you wouldn't need it unless you're in a trivia contest and explaining to people. Or one day you're teaching a class like this and you want to have it. Okay, so chapter 1. The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tabernacle of meeting. So now it's built, God speaks to Moses. And I sometimes wonder, remember before it's built, Moses would go out to the edge of the camp and the pillar would come down there. I don't have the references written down here, but We put the pieces together. It seems like Moses would go into the holy place, not the holy of holies, because he's not allowed, but implies he would hear a voice from the other side of the veil, as though God were sitting on the mercy seat and talking to him. Sure, God made that happen. It's not like God is in a box, you know, and he has to stay in that tent all the time. But God spoke to him there, and it's on the first day of the second month, the second year after they'd come out of the land of Egypt. So we know where we're at here. Numbers, as I said, begins about 13 months after Exodus. And I've got this underlined three times, noting what's about to happen. They focused on getting the law and how they're going to run their country, how they're going to worship. All this information is here. Now we could say it's time to organize the masses. They traipsed out of Egypt and perhaps sort of pell-mell. We're not sure how they were organized, if at all. They just camped around the mountain. But now as opposed to giving law and giving procedure, we're getting down to what we could call nuts and bolts, although I don't think they had any literal nuts and bolts, except for nuts on trees, but they're going to start getting organized. You, get over there. You, get here. We've got to move people. We've got to get things set up. We've got to organize how we're going to travel when we travel. And that's a lot of what happens. But first, we want to know how many of us we've got and how they're grouped. So verse 2, take a census of all the congregation of the children of Israel by their families, by their fathers' houses, according to the number of names, every male individually. This is the first census of Israel. There was a reference that they would do one back in Exodus 38, verse 26. So this doesn't probably surprise Moses. Exodus 38, 26, God had mentioned, you're going to do a count. Which reminds us then, is taking a census of Israel a sin? I would say if God says do it, it's not a sin. But I'm asking the question for a valid reason, which I'm sure most of you remember. Julia. Oh, I forgot. We want to have this.
I mean, I think the reason you're asking that question is because I think it was David that took a census, and it angered God. But that was because God specifically said, don't take a census. And for that specific, like David did it, I believe, power reasons or number reasons, army. I don't remember the exact reason.
You know, because the Bible doesn't tell us an exact reason, but we sort of read in, yeah, he did it for wrong reasons. Emily, you wanted to add to that. And by the way, the reference is in 2 Samuel chapter 24, where we see that story happening.
Don't we like kind of make the assumption, I guess, that it was because he had, I guess, a little bit of a lack of faith, thinking that they needed the number?
It could be, yeah. Like he was looking to his physical strength and power, and you know that's sort of implied, and I tend to think that he wasn't motivated for right reasons. And perhaps was lacking faith, and he learned a powerful lesson through it. But we want to realize it's not sinful in itself to take a census. Matter of fact, I might skip ahead in my notes. We could ask, what are some reasons? What would the information be useful for? I've got a list of four things that, I don't know if that's comprehensive, but four came to my mind. What do you do once you know how many you have? Yes, Andrew. Okay. Yeah, we know you've gone through Joshua. Eventually, they're going to cast lots and they're going to give them so much land. And to the larger tribes, they'll give a bigger segment, smaller tribes a smaller segment. So yeah, it's good to know how many you got when we're dividing up the land. Some other things we might not find examples, but you might remember the story of Jesus Christ, what some call the Christmas story, which it's not, but remember Caesar sent out a decree that they had to do a census. Joseph and Mary had to go to Bethlehem to be counted. For what reason? Okay, taxes. Yeah, taxation fits well with doing a census. Okay, at least that information is useful because in a lot of cases, you know, they didn't have Social Security numbers and deduction from paychecks back then. A lot of times, through most of history, taxation was done by the government hires what they called a tax farmer, which is an English term, but it'd be like, I might say, David, I want you to tax the ABC class. Get so much money from them. Now, how do I know how much money I should get from them? Well, if I know there's 20 students, I might come up with a number. You know, and I'd say next year's class there's going to be 40 students, which would be nice. I don't know if there are, but I might. So in other words, the government doesn't have all these individual stuff, but I can get a good estimate by knowing. Sorry, you look like you want to say something, Kayla.
I'm a little confused about the Exodus 38.
Did you look there? Did I have the wrong scripture?
What verse is it, 26?
Yeah, 38:26 is what I have written down.
So
that there's a reference to a census.
There's a reference to a census, but it sounds like they already did it. It says, for everyone, an amount of money for each man according to the shekel of the sanctuary. For everyone included in the numbering from 20 years old and above, for 603,550 men.
Yeah.
So had they already done the census?
I think not, because we're going to go through. I think that's a reference. No, it's a good question. It's like, okay, why are they doing a census if they already know these numbers? I would interpret it as, okay, Moses wrote that in later once he did know the numbers, but God had told him, look, I want you to gather a half shekel from each person. And later on, he's okay, this is how much we had. Matter of fact, I'm going to make reference to that in a moment when we talk about some challenges in the Hebrew numbers. So, yeah, I think this is a matter of it sort of being backlogged Danny?
Is it possible that he wrote multiple books after the census had already been done? And so that book, so both books had been written around the same time and he had already taken the census.
It is possible. Yeah, remember, he's going to end up having 39 years on his hands when he might be writing or revising and editing. So there's questions. I don't think he finished Exodus before he started Leviticus and doesn't touch it again. Any of you have written very much, like if you've written to submit to a newspaper, an article, or a magazine, you write something, you go back and rewrite it, you go back and rewrite it, and then you go back and change, and then an editor gets a hold of it and they change it again. I'm going to slow myself down. The coffee's really hitting speed. Okay, let me give you a couple other reasons. One is assigning work duties. Now, this applies more in when nations are established, but it wasn't uncommon before governments just took money. Sometimes they got a group of people and they'd say, we need to fix the roads. Instead of all of you send in your taxes and we hire a construction company, when it's physically people getting out with shovels and picks, you might say, okay, town of Milford, send us 8,000 men. How do I know 8,000? Because I know how many people live in Milford. There's a word for that. It's called a corvée. Not a Corvette, that's a cool car. A corvée is a calling on labor from the masses as part of your duty to the nation. And I'm not sure how far that comes back. I've seen it referred to a lot in middle age history. Not middle age like in your 40s, but the medieval times. Okay, other one is organization for war. You know, hey, you know, we got to get some troops together. Remember, David had that in mind. So God didn't want David to do it that way then, but Israel is going to make war when they go into the promised land. It's funny because I put these notes together some time ago, and on my notes for this is number two on my list, it says, organizing, war, and or marking. And that's where it stops, and I'm wondering, what was I thinking? Well, I'm not sure what I was marking, so I just thought I'd point it out. So, and let's go back to the rules of the census. By the way, we're not going to read through all of chapter 1, because I'm hoping some of you at some point in your life have and will again. It's a little dry reading. The main census is going to count only men 20 years and older. Not any women, not any children. It's interesting, 20 and older, we could use this, we could make a case for that being a logical place to count the age of adulthood. You know, in our nation today, it's generally counted as 21 for the sake of drinking, 18 for the sake of voting and serving in the military. You know, if we wanted a biblical model, it might be 20. Now, it does say, and it's in verse 3, 20 years old and above all who are able to go to war in Israel. So some scholars have questioned, does that mean men who were old enough to not be able to go to war were not counted? It's a question for which I don't have an answer. Most people assume it's 20 years old and up, and you know, you just count them as being able to go to war until they fall over dead. But some have questioned there might be a part of the population older that's not included, aside from men and women. So it's a hanging question that I don't think has great consequence. The count was to be organized by tribe and clan, and at this point would not include the tribe of Levi. We'll see them counted later separately. Okay, so we got the basis here. Verses 4 through 16 will basically describe a team of men responsible for doing this. A leader of each tribe would participate. Some would say perhaps it's the leader of each tribe. It's room to discuss or debate whether it's the leader or a leader. In chapter 2, it describes each of them. They're mentioned as the captain. And the King James Version or other translations call each of these men the leader of the camp once their tribes are gathered in their camps. So these men, you know, it's not like they're dictators, the king of each tribe, but they're the foremost leader or elder. Now, I'll point out one anomaly that's just worth knowing perhaps where it came from. Chapter 1, verse 14 mentions from Gad, Eliaseph, the son of Deuel. Glad my dad wasn't named Deuel. But in chapter 2, verse 14, it mentions Eliaseph and calls him the son of Reuel, having an R where there's a D. This is almost certainly the same Eliaseph and is probably a copying error that happened over time. Just want to point out some critics of the Bible will say, see, the Bible is not reliable. No, I think the Bible is reliable, but somebody's penmanship at some time was not. And as somebody with terrible penmanship, I can easily see where that could happen. Okay, results of the census. Matter of fact, I made a copy of a chart out of one of the books. I'm not going to be like Dr. Urweiler and walk around and hand each of you one. I see a value to that, but also see how it takes a lot of time. I'll let you take one and pass it on, but I will walk all the way back here. But you'll hang on to this. Well, I'm giving it to you because I'm assuming you'll hang on to it. I'm not going to comment a lot on the numbers, but in chapter 26, we'll look at the fact that they'll do a census again, and it'll be interesting to note the changes. Okay, so you see, basically we've got, rough comparison. Some tribes are bigger than others. So hold the thought. I already mentioned reasons you would take a census and what you do with the numbers. Things like taxation, allotting land, assigning work duties, organizing for war. I want to jump ahead all the way to verse 46. And we see the total. All who were numbered of the children of Israel by their fathers' houses from 20 years old and above who were able to go to war. All who were numbered were 603,550. So we got a specific number. How many men went into Egypt? Anybody remember that number? Yes.
Was it 70?
70. So this is a pretty significant increase. The 70 was only men. This is only men. If this happened only over the course of 215 years, which one school of thought says it did, that's pretty impressive. That's a high birth rate and a low death rate. If it happened over about 400 years, it's less impressive, but still kind of impressive. Considering we're going to do another census 39 years later, and the numbers will almost be the same. So there's a rapid rise. You got a, well, they say a steep slope, but eventually it's going to level off, for whatever reasons. Most people guess that there was probably nearly an equal number of women. In the human race as a whole, generally, we get about even numbers. It's funny how it balances out. I was thinking families here locally. This came to mind, something sparked it, but I was thinking of a couple of our larger families. Anyways, this is a way of looking. Sometimes families have all but guys, sometimes they have all boys, but in the long run, it balances out. So, they're still having kids that are not counted. So, in general, we make estimates. How many do you think there were? If there were 600,000 and so many men, probably another 600,000 or so women, and who knows how many kids. Most men and women, once they pair up, had more than one or two kids. So we come down, a lot of people say anywhere from 2.5 to 3 million, maybe a bit more, maybe a bit less. Large numbers, considering the 70 men and probably about 70 women that entered Egypt. Modern Bible critics have disputed these numbers. Okay, some of them said, that's ridiculous. You just can't have that many, especially wandering around here in the wilderness with nothing to eat and nothing to drink. Remember, modern Bible critics don't particularly believe in miracles. And there's one thing they hang a lot of their criticism on, and that's the Hebrew word elip. I'm not sure of the pronunciation. It's often transliterated this way. Elip has a couple of different meanings, probably has more than one, but one is simple. It's the number 1,000. But it can also, the same Hebrew word can also be used to mean clan or family. And in some cases, a captain or leader as related to a family. Now, why is that so significant? Well, what if where our King James Bible says 603,000 men, maybe it's 603 elip, maybe 603 families. How many people does it take to make a family? Okay, well, yeah, minimum two, I guess, a marriage. Often, let's say an average family is five, or if we want to go big, get them all together, you might have 40 people together. 40 people is way less than 1,000. Okay, so there's a big difference. Say 40,000 people between 40 families or clans that may have anywhere, say, 6 to 50 people. The difference, and I'm just speaking theoretically here, so I'm leading to something, the difference between about 2,000 or only 240. And so a lot of scholars say we should be looking at this meaning when we describe all these numbers, not this meaning. Emily, I'll let you get a comment or a question in.
But it said that they were supposed to number the men, right?
Right.
So that
wouldn't be... Yeah, well, what they would say is once all you've done this counting, this is what you have. So they would answer, yeah, you count the men and you've got this many. Okay, but I think you're on to something. Because that's one reason we might use to say, no, I don't think that's the meaning they were using. There's another and very important reason. Because in addition to numbering how many thousands they have, what other units did they use? Pretty basic one. Where are we at in chapter 46? 603,000 and 550. The Hebrew word for hundred doesn't have an alternate meaning that fits this. So, okay, we could have 603,000 and 500. We can't have 603 families of 40 or so and 500 people. You know, you couldn't have 240 people and then 500. That it just doesn't flow. The logic doesn't hold up. And that's what it's worth looking internally and saying, okay, you guys, I understand the word has two different meanings, but it's pretty clear they meant this meaning. There are some other reasons to say that our traditional interpretation would fit. One is the narrative when they were back in Exodus, the narrative of Exodus. Like in Exodus 1 and verse 9, when the Israelites were having babies left and right, the Egyptian says, the Israelites are more and mightier than we. We got to control them lest they fall in with our enemies. Okay, the Israelites are more and mightier than me works if you got 600,000 men and maybe 3 million people over. But if you've only got 15,000 men, I don't think the Egyptians are that worried. One more. Let's get back to what Kayla so cleverly pointed out earlier. In Exodus 38, starting in verse 25, they had to collect a half a shekel apiece from all the men, and they would get, 100 talents, 1,775 shekels of gold. Okay. If we take a common way of measuring that and say that there were 3,000 shekels for each talent, and there are different ways of measuring, but that one is not just made up, you would divide that by how many people? Comes out to 603,550 contributors. The math works for elip to mean 1,000, not clan or family, and for it to be a bunch of people. Believing that the Israelites could reproduce that quickly, believing that so many of them could survive in a desert wilderness where there's no regular food supply or water, requires the belief in divine miracles. And as I said, modern Bible critics don't believe in divine miracles. But you know what? I do. And I'm guessing most of you do. I haven't seen miracles on that scale in my own life, but I've pointed out the fact that we understand what we're reading and we see things in our life. We see divine miracles all the time that we don't see as big as quail from the sky piling up to our knees or something just appearing on the ground every morning that we can go out and eat and it melts away when the sun comes up, but we do see miracles. So I wanted to address that because I'd hate for you to later on come across some scholarly writing that makes you think, numbers is totally wrong. It was only a handful of people wandering around in the wilderness, bumping into Bedouins, and later on they made up this story about their national origin. Because that's what you can find in a lot of books. I don't think those books are right. They're just trying to come up with an excuse for there not being a real God and him not working through this nation. And the logic and even the math within the Bible does make sense and holds together. So, and I don't want to deal with it longer than that. I just wanted you to be aware of that. Okay, I wondered if I'd get through 5 chapters or 6 chapters today, which actually I thought maybe 1 or 2. I'm hoping to get to the end of 1. Let's pick up from chapter 47. It tells us, but the Levites were not numbered among them by their father's tribe. Okay, and it says, verse 49, only the tribe of Levi you shall not number or take a census among the children of Israel. Doesn't mean you won't take a census, because in a little bit we will take a census. And we'll see the results of that in chapter 3, verse 39. The Levites were counted separately because they were devoted to the service of the tabernacle. So when they do a census for them, it's not going to be males 20 years old and older. It's going to be males 1 month and older. Now, I can attest to this. Two-month-old babies are not working in the tabernacle, but they did do a count of how many they had. But because they're not, this count is not for the purposes of paying taxes, going to war, digging on the roads, God numbered them differently. And I've got, oh yeah, here in my notes, they weren't recruited for warfare the same as others did. They didn't pay taxes apparently in the same way. Significantly, they didn't receive land in the same way. So a lot of the reasons for the census of the others don't apply to Leviticus, or to the Levites. So they're counted by a different standard, but they are going to be counted. Remember, they're given villages scattered all throughout Israel. So it's not that they get nothing. Matter of fact, they get to live off the tithe, which is pretty important. Oh, and by the way, if you might want to add this to your chart or not, but in chapter 3, verse 39, it tells us when they did do that count of the tribe of Levi from 1 month and old, it came out to 22,000, which makes Levi far and away the smallest tribe. And we could speculate as to why that was. Maybe they just weren't as fertile or other things. There's other speculations, but they're a lot smaller group. Okay, actually, I'm not going to delve into chapter 2 as we move ahead and, as I said, getting things organized in the camp of Israel.